is Kate Moorhead Carroll and the podcast Find It. Today I have with me my very own husband, Dr. Chris Carroll. Chris, thank you so much for being here with me this morning.
Oh, you're welcome.
People in the cathedral are always so curious about you, honey, because there you are sitting in one of the first rows being such a good husband. I'm very blessed to have you. So Chris is a pediatric intensive care doctor, which means he sees very sick children, and he sees sometimes children die or be forever paralyzed or disabled. And I wanted to talk to you, Chris, about your life and your faith and how you felt called to do this really difficult kind of work, a work that most people, I don't think, can even really hear about, right? You don't really talk about it much, do you?
No, I joke that my job is a conversation ender, and I try to avoid it, talking about it whenever possible. If you're at a dinner party or wherever, and people ask you what you do, I usually say I'm a pediatrician, and then they say, then it gets around to pediatric ICU doctor if really pushed, because they don't like to imagine that there are children in that position or that their children could be in a position like that. Mm-hmm. So they don't like to imagine critically ill children, but they're there. Those children are there nonetheless, and somebody right. needs to take care of them.
Yeah, so that must be part of why you feel like that this is a role that God would want you to play, because someone has to be there for them in that scary place.
Yes, if I wasn't there caring for them, they would still be there. Yeah. I think you have to view a job like this as a mission, as a vocation, because otherwise it's just too hard to do. You know, you're there to serve people and to help people through these really dark times, and if you don't have some faith to back it up, I think it gets really hard.
Yeah, I bet. I know you've told me on numerous occasions that you see a greater percentage of child abuse down in Florida. Is it from Florida and Southern Georgia both, or?
Yeah, so we serve, our hospital serves Northern Florida and Southern Georgia, and we have a large population of kids coming in from Southern Georgia, and that was a big surprise for me. I had done some moonlighting in Alaska, so I was used to an increased amount of childhood trauma up there. We would frequently see children, I'd see about like a child a week dying up there, or sometimes more than that, which is a lot in a state of only 730,000 people in Alaska. So I was a little bit used to that, but still the amount of child abuse that I see down here in Florida is far in excess of what I saw in Connecticut, and I don't have any reason for that. I just, maybe it's a lack of services down here and support for the families. Maybe it's all the poverty. There's much more poverty down here than there is in New England.
Mm, yeah. Well, let's go back to the beginning of your life. So you grew up a Roman Catholic, right? Tell us about your family.
I did. I'm still a Roman Catholic.
Yes, I know.
I haven't converted yet. You're
a very Episcopal
Roman
Catholic.
You like to joke that my large extended family is really Episcopalian. Yeah. They just don't know it yet. Yes. I do come from a very large Catholic family. My grandfather was the oldest of 13 children, and of them, four were priests and two were nuns, and and they all lived in a very small area of Connecticut, around Milford, Connecticut, my whole life. And I have 20 some odd cousins and many, many second
Irish
cousins
Catholic
and
family.
A really, real Irish Catholic family. And everybody goes to, everyone goes to Mass every week. And, it's very, very strong Irish Catholic family. I don't want to use the word liberal, but it was a very socially liberal a way of viewing the world, because my grandfather was they were very progressive in a lot of ways. They didn't really they didn't really care if you were gay, or they mm-hmm. didn't really care what race you were. You know, mm-hmm. there were people who married people in other races. There were people in the family who were gay. And I think, you know, the having a large family, that's going to happen. You're going to have people who are going to marry people of a different race.
There's nothing like the love of a relative to open your heart and mind.
Yeah, right? Yeah. And so progressive.
Yeah, tell them about your Uncle Jimmy, because he was quite a figure.
Yeah, he was a big figure in the family. He was the youngest boy of the 13 kids. And so there were so many kids, and my grandfather was the oldest. So my mother was only 8 years older than the 8 years younger than the youngest child. So my Aunt Mary, who we talked about a lot, who was very close to me, is a sister of mercy, and she kind of followed me around. Not really. She lived in D.C. when I was in D.C. And then I moved to Connecticut, and she was not far from me in Connecticut, so I saw her a lot. She was the youngest, and then just above her was my Uncle Jimmy, and they all came from very, I don't want to use the word charismatic, because I think that means something different in the Protestant tradition than it does than I'm using it. But mm-hmm. They were really good preachers. Even the ones who weren't priests, I had an uncle who was a storyteller for a job. That was his job. He was a storyteller. Yeah. And the ones who were priests were excellent preachers. And my uncle Jimmy, he was a strong advocate for lots of things. He got really involved in Haiti and in trying to address some of the poverty down there. And his church was in Arlington, Virginia, Our Lady Queen of Peace in Arlington, Virginia. And it was frequented by everyone from people who worked, high up in the NSA, it wasn't NSA back then, but in the CIA and the other intelligence operations and the Pentagon, as well as, local, very poor African Americans from the community. And it was a very diverse church, and they were the church that airlifted a bulldozer to one of the mountaintops in Haiti and created a runway so that planes could land and deliver food to some of these very remote things. So they were he was very involved in that. I was the oldest of my cousins, and I was probably in my late teens, and this was in the late 80s, I imagine mm-hmm. it was. Everybody found out that Jimmy had AIDS,
and he was a Roman Catholic priest.
He was a Roman Catholic priest, who had AIDS, yeah. Uh-huh. And he was encouraged to lie about it to people mm-hmm. and say he got it from a blood transfusion or something else. And he actually came out in the National Catholic Reporter, which is a Catholic journal that people get, and said he had been unfaithful to his vows, and that's how he had gotten it from in D.C. in the 80s. And so everybody in the family knew, and so we're and loved Jimmy, and obviously weren't going to turn our backs on him. So he eventually died of AIDS in 97. He was doing same gender marriages in secret in the 90s, throughout the 90s.
Yeah, yeah. You know, I think I've mentioned this to you once before, but it's kind of like in Harry Potter with those. I don't know if any of you who are listening have read the Harry Potter books, but there are these thestrals that can be seen only by someone who has seen death. So, in other words, the experience of seeing death opens your eyes to view things in a new way. And I think that when you love someone who is queer, it opens your eyes, and you can see the world.
Yeah, I think that's a great example. It's like they're not people who don't know anyone who's gay, or don't know anyone who's had to deal with the challenges of racism. They don't love someone like that. It's not that they are, it's not that their hearts are hardened to those issues, they're just completely unaware of them because they don't have any experience in that regard. Mm-hmm. So, you know, broadening your community, like I had a big community like that growing up in my family. Mm-hmm. So, you know, of course we were all, mm-hmm. and it was funny because some of my, I mean, I have a lot of relatives who are cops and, and you know, the people will joke, they'll be like, you look at our family and you'd think we'd be the most conservative freaking family in the world. And, but you know, we have all these family members who have faced these challenges mm-hmm. and, yeah. And, that's so, wonderful. You know, and we still love them. So we, you know,
yeah. Well, and Chris, I know because, you know, for those of you who are listening, Chris and I went to the same high school, and he was my first kiss in high school. And then we didn't really date, though. We were the leads in a musical together, which was awesome. But when we communicated with one another after my divorce, we realized that we both had been so devout during high school. So your parents were getting a divorce, Chris, and you went to mass.
Oh yeah,
every morning, right?
Yeah,
during Lent.
I did.
And why did you do that? What did it do for you at the time?
I don't know. I was surprisingly active in my church growing up as a kid. I would visit people in some of the elder communities and the old folks' homes back then. I would do it weekly. I remember I showed up for one of the meetings and one of my aunts who was, she's like, what are you doing here, Chris? she had no idea.
Yeah. Show up to other people's
but
homes. Awesome.
she had no idea that I was visiting people weekly. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, I just felt called to do it. And it's why I think the Episcopal Church has such strong attraction to me, because you know, a lot of those old, very ritualistic and older ways of practicing are still alive and well in the Episcopal Church too, as well. The same like they are in the Roman Catholic Church.
But one of the things we do is that the Episcopal Church welcomes Chris as a member, and he doesn't have to be Episcopalian. He can be himself.
Yes. Well, you would not be welcome in the Catholic Church.
I would not be able to be a priest. Right.
So I will, or even welcome to take communion,
which
is a real problem. I think a lot of Catholics, it's weird, a lot of Catholics, I think, have no problems with completely discounting the Catholic rules. So like, well, that's just silly.
And, they stay Catholic because it's their culture and tradition.
So
you got to Georgetown and you majored in theology, but you were also pre-med. So, well, first of all, let's go back a little bit. When did you first feel that you were called to be a doctor? At what age and what happened?
I was one of those kids that knew I wanted to be a doctor from a very early age. I don't know why. I just felt like that was something that I wanted to do. I was always learning and memorization came very easy to me. And I liked I think in the beginning I liked the scientific challenges more than I liked the human challenges, but I kept coming back to the human challenges. So I think, I think those two things merged over time. I think, clearly I had this large part of my life that involved helping other people, and that was a big part of what was important to me. But then I was also very excited about the learning and the understanding. And so finding a way to marry those two aspects was really attractive to me. I think like most young people, a lot of that is subconscious rather than conscious. You come to it later and then it all seems so obvious in retrospect.
So, and Georgetown is a Roman Catholic college, but
Georgetown's
it's Jesuit.
Catholic.
It's Jesuits, Jesuit. Yes. Very intellectual, very academic. What made you want to take theology classes?
So there is all undergraduates at Georgetown have to take a class called The Problem of God, which essentially addresses the issue of God is all loving and God is all powerful, and then why does there evil exist in this world?
Yes, the question of theodicy.
Theodicy, yes. Yeah. God is either not all loving or not all powerful if there evil exists in the world. And so you wrestle with that for an entire semester, and it's a required first semester class at Georgetown. That brought up a lot of issues. You know, that was a really interesting part of it. And Georgetown also is one of those schools where, you know, there's a priest on the dorm floor. The Jesuits are embedded in the educational experience. I joined a singing group early on an a cappella singing group that was like a fraternal organization. It is a sort of a fraternal organization. They let in about 3 people a year, and it's been going on since the 1940s. There was a priest who was a member of this group throughout the whole organization. One of the Jesuits was part of it. In the beginning, it was the Jesuit was brought in to, I think, kind of proctor them, but then it morphed into more of a mentoring sort of role. But that's too much, because the Jesuits don't really mentor. They guide you in ways that are less overt.
Mm-hmm. That's wonderful. It's perfect.
I remember very early saying to people that, you know, when am I going to get the opportunity to study something like this again? If I'm going to be a doctor, I'm going to go to med school. I'm not going to get the chance to study something like this again. So I really wanted to do it, and I took advantage of it. And so, I remember I called my mother saying that I was majoring in theology, and she started to cry.
She thought you'd be poor for the rest of your life.
She said, what are you going to do with that? And I said, I'm going to go to med school.
That's a wonderful balance. Oh, so you, after college at Georgetown, you went to Georgetown Medical School, and then you went to Northwestern for your residency, right?
Yeah.
And it's in residency that you determine the area of medicine. Is that correct?
So you actually determine it at the end of your med school. So I was wrestling between pediatrics and radiology, which are two very different fields.
Wow,
and
they are different.
They are very different fields. I actually interviewed for both pediatrics and radiology. And at the time, radiology was sort of had a match program. People have probably heard of the match program, where medical students submit where they want to go, and schools submit the people that they want to take, and then a computer program matches them, and then at the same time, at the same day, everyone finds out exactly where they're going to go.
Wow.
It's a match. Mm-hmm. So you don't know where you're going to live.
It reminds me of like the NBA.
It's incredibly, it's a big deal. There's a big, it's a big spectacle associated with it. Radiology at the time wasn't really in the match, and so I actually got offered a number of jobs, but I decided that I think the reason I was thinking about radiology at the time was more of the intellectual component. I really liked the intellectual components mm-hmm. behind radiology. I really liked the challenges, and particularly the interventional radiology parts, the procedural parts of it, I really enjoyed.
Interventional, what does that mean?
So that means, for example, if somebody had a stroke, for example, that would be the person who would go in and help direct the catheter to deliver the anti-clotting medication.
They're using
radiology to do procedures. Putting in different lines, putting in different tubes to drain abscesses mm-hmm. and things. And I really liked that as well. In the end, I felt like I really would miss the patient contact. Mm-hmm. In radiology, most of your patients are
unconscious.
You don't meet them, or they're unconscious. I really decided that I needed to go into pediatrics. And once I was in pediatrics, pediatric ICU just grabbed me immediately. I liked the acute care aspect of it. I really liked emergency medicine and neonatology as well, but I think that there was for me more of a challenge in pediatric ICU. What I really enjoy about it is both I'm learning something every day. I see diseases and syndromes you know, that I may not have seen ever or maybe several years prior. So I'm always learning something, as well as I get to help people during, you know, the worst times in their lives.
Well, and I think we think about the ICU as children dying, but in reality, a lot of them get totally better.
Oh, yeah.
And you can really save a child's life in the pediatric ICU. I bet you've done that a number
of
times,
yeah.
Particularly with respiratory things, just bringing them right back from the brink of death.
Oh, it's incredibly rewarding in that regard. Yeah, I think that when people, part of people's really revulsion to the idea of pediatric ICU, revulsion is perhaps a bad word, but they bristle at pediatric ICU as they extrapolate an adult ICU mortality to kids. In adult ICUs, 33% of adult ICU patients, or about a third of adult ICU patients, die.
Yeah.
That would be horrific in pediatrics. In pediatrics, our numbers are much smaller than that. We, you know, our numbers are in the neighborhood of 1%. So, I mean, it's
children
much
are resilient.
Smaller.
Their bodies are
much
resilient.
More resilient.
Yeah.
Much more resilient. And the vast majority of the kids I see are going to go on to live, you know, long and happy lives, and I'll never see them again, which
true.
Is great. So.
But you do see some chronically physically disabled children as well that you probably see over years, right?
We do.
Would you talk about that dynamic?
We do. Yeah, that was that's a dynamic. Those patients have become very. Those patients are very, and their families are very dear to me. They really care for those. Those children in a way that is really unimaginable. You can really see God's hand in caring for their children, because they, you know, many of these children can have limited interactivity with the world. You know, their parents interact with them in ways that we sometimes can't really even see. You know, if an outsider looks at it, you don't really see very much change, but their families will tell you, no, no, this is him happy, this is him sad.
Oh, that's beautiful.
And they require constant care, and there's just... it's very, you know, as we've gotten better and better at treating children with critical illnesses, we've built up this huge population of kids with chronic critical illness that need round the clock care. These are kids who would not have survived even 20 years ago. And certainly there are many other countries in which there are none of these children, because
they just die.
When I was in Alaska, there were none of those children, because the families who have them realize very quickly that there are no services available for them in Alaska because of how far away, you know, there's just the population density is so it's so not very dense, so they have to move to states where there is more
better
density
care.
And better services and more support.
So when you went to Alaska, you would relieve a doctor for a week, is that correct?
Yeah, I would
so
work
you would
up there for a week.
24/7 for an entire week
yes.
in charge of an ICU?
Yes,
Lord.
I know. You really hated
yeah,
it when I
know.
Did that.
The sleep deprivation part really scared me. You
yes,
know?
Yes. Yeah. Yes, there were days I was up for several days in a row.
Oh,
I know
wow.
you hated that.
Yeah. One of the things I've tried to do as Chris's wife is make him take care of himself, which is new for him, I think.
Yes.
Yeah. But... So when a child is dying, what do you say to the parents to try to stand in that dark place?
Oh boy, you know, I think there are some tenets, some things you have to remind yourself, but I think a lot of it is being in the moment and being open in a very human and sympathetic way to those families. You know, I think you always want to be very specific. You want to, you know, if their child is dying, you want to say the word dying. When their child has died, you want to say the word died. If their child has cancer, you want to say the word cancer. You know, you need to use the words.
The truth is
you
always
need to
better.
Use the words
yes.
and not beat around the bush.
Yeah.
They're looking for those words. They need them. But you also, you know, once you've said those words, they're not hearing anything else. So you need to let them sit with that for a while. And they will frequently ask the same questions over and over again. My personal record is three times in a row, a father asked me the exact same question three times in a row. Mm-hmm. and he couldn't remember what I said to him on either one God of those three him. Things. Yeah. I think the advantage of being in an intensive care unit is that I can sit with them for a while and then leave them for themselves and come back in a half hour and sit with them some more and talk with them some more and come back. Mm-hmm. And I also, the advantage of being in a pediatric ICU is that I have a whole team of people. I have chaplains and social workers and nurses and respiratory therapists and residents and mm-hmm. advanced practice providers, all of whom can provide a kind of a,
almost a framework.
There's a term they use. We kind of surround these families in the intensive care unit with a huge amount of services. And not just the ones who are dying, but the ones who are just sick. We can really support them in a way that is really wonderful. And I think this is getting off topic a little bit, but when they age out, it can be really hard because suddenly they've been in this little cocoon where people have been caring for them.
Children when they become adults, it's a hard transition.
It's a hard transition because then suddenly it's all on the parents. Mm. They don't have those support systems that are there in the pediatric ICUs. They're just another adult with a chronic disease, it's hard in. Here in Jacksonville, we don't care for people much past their 18th birthday. In Connecticut, we cared for people well into their 20s and sometimes even later than that. We develop really close long-term relationships with them. I had parents, when I told them I was leaving Connecticut, crying. I've had parents calling me afterwards. I had a parent call me and tell me, I said, I promised you I would call you and tell you when he got released from the hospital. And he got released from the hospital today. And this was like 6 or 7 months after I left Connecticut, the child was finally got better enough to leave the hospital.
I want to close with something that you said before, Chris, but maybe you could elaborate on it. Sometimes you'll come home after things have been hard and you'll say, Christ has no hands but mine.
Yes.
So tell me about how you view that. How do you understand that?
I think that's obviously a very important core belief of mine that we are the way that God acts in the world. And if we want good things to happen in the world, we need to be the ones to do it. Christ has no hands on earth but ours is something that I've tried to live by through my life, that we are there to help other people and to help them through this process. If I wasn't there in the ICU, those kids would still be there. I just wouldn't know about them.
Well, thank you so much, honey, for doing this for me and all of you out there. Thanks for listening. God bless you and have a wonderful day.
Thank you for joining me in the podcast, Find It. Remember that if you keep searching for the divine presence, you will find it. I want to invite you, if you're interested in hearing more of these podcasts, to subscribe. Just hit the subscribe button and you will be informed of new episodes. And before we part ways, I pray that God will bless you and hold you, give you peace. Until we meet again.